Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Pennsylvania is comparing regulations for above-ground storage tanks after the spill in West Virginia.
We have all those measures in place that West Virginia didn't necessarily have.
While some residents in a Kentucky community are using unique strategies to oppose a strip mine, others are looking forward to the mine opening.
And that's what I don't understand when people want to be negative. Well, if it don't benefit me, I won't, you know. It's going to benefit everybody.
One school in West Virginia is working to meet the needs of all deaf and blind students.
They come here each month, already established friendships.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly, in for Cecilia Mason. So far, the West Virginia legislature has responded to the chemical leak that contaminated the drinking water for 300,000 customers with two new bills. State Senator John Unger, a Democrat, is proposing legislation that would regulate all above-ground storage tanks. Governor Earl Ray Tomlin, also a Democrat, introduced a bill that has been criticized by the environmental consulting firm Downstream Strategies. President Evan Hansen says the governor's bill is too limited by focusing only on above-ground chemical storage tanks and not other places that might contaminate the waters. Still, Hansen told West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Beneduccio that regulations are just the first step.
A chemical spill into the Elk River not only prevented 300,000 West Virginians from using water for several days, but it put other communities from nearby states on alert, including downstream cities like Cincinnati. The spills created an environment of anxiety and frustration for residents, but it's also brought up red flags to people like Evan Hansen, president of Downstream Strategies.
Our state leaders need to set a new tone in which it's their expectation that the DEP holds all industries, including those in the coal industry, fully and consistently accountable for meeting their permits.
Hansen says new regulations are good, but he questions how well they will be enforced with an understaffed DEP. As a state agency, the DEP faces budget cuts.
It needs more funds and needs more staff. And they need to not just have those funds and have that staff, but they need to be directed that they're to use those funds and use those new staff to perform more inspections and to enforce the permits. They need to better prioritize their inspections, because no matter how many inspectors they have, they're not going to be able to be everywhere. And one way to prioritize their inspections is to make sure that those sites that store the most hazardous materials in the largest quantities in the most sensitive locations are inspected first and frequently.
Hansen says in West Virginia, chemical storage facilities usually operate under what he calls general permits from the State Department of Environmental Protection. These include stormwater permits that do not necessarily require public comment. Hansen says that needs to change.
General permits are pre-written permits that the DEP updates every 5 years for categories of sites. The permit at issue here for Freedom Industries is a general permit written for industrial sites that have stormwater discharges. To get covered under that permit, Freedom Industries does what's called get a registration. They provide some information to the DEP about what they're going to do on site to prevent discharges of pollution and contamination of groundwater. But essentially, the terms and conditions of the permit are pre-written, and they simply get a registration. General permits only undergo public notice and comment when DEP writes the general permit, not when facilities register under the general permit.
Hansen adds individual permits are site-specific, with writing and considerations included that specifically consider the site itself.
there's no public notice and comment for general permits. And that's needed for these facilities so that people who live in the area and are potentially affected by spills have a chance to weigh in and provide feedback during the permitting process.
Every coal mine, every power plant, and larger wastewater treatment plants are regulated under these more stringent permits, according to Hansen, but not at a place like the Freedom site.
The actions that have occurred at Freedom Industries strongly suggest that it is totally inappropriate for them to be granted coverage under a general permit due to the large amounts of harmful chemicals stored at those facilities.
Downstream Strategies worked on a report called The Freedom Industries Spill, Lessons Learned and Needed Reforms. And Downstream is actually studying another spill. Hansen says in Morgantown, a spill occurred at a site that stores chemicals used in the hydraulic fracturing process. Some material spilled into a tributary of the Monongahela River. He says Downstream contacted the spill hotline at the Department of Environmental Protection, and Downstream's investigation is ongoing as to what happened. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beneduccio in Morgantown.
The chemical leak at Freedom Industries that left 300,000 people without water in West Virginia brings up questions in other states, like Pennsylvania, about the possibility of other water contamination catastrophes. There have been spills in Pennsylvania waterways before, and regulators say those incidents have led to more strict state laws. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that regulators say a spill is less likely in Pennsylvania than in West Virginia, and that if one occurs, they could respond quickly.
It's cold and cloudy on Neville Island in the Ohio River, a few miles west of downtown Pittsburgh. The eastern end of the island is thick with chemical and industrial plants belching out smoke and steam.
On one end of the island is the intake is the water intake. On the other end of the island is the neighborhood.
Cassie Steenblock is with Clean Water Action. The water intake and treatment plant she mentioned sits in the midst of the chemical facilities. It pulls from the Ohio to provide 200,000 people with water. Standing across the street from large chemical storage tanks, Steenblock worries that a chemical leak here could cause problems similar to last week's spill in West Virginia.
We would see the problems here. There would be water pollution into the Ohio. There would be the effect of the families here. So this is a place where, you know, you can see the effects of how this can happen anywhere and to anyone, and it could happen here in Pittsburgh.
State regulators agree.
Releases certainly can happen anywhere, regardless of the regulations that are in place.
That's Chris Schiffer of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. Schiffer is with the Division of Storage Tanks. Yes, storage tanks have their own division in Pennsylvania.
Where we do regulate the tanks, we do have emergency containment requirements, we do have monitoring requirements.
Schiffer says these provisions came about after hard experience, like one spill in 1988. In that accident, a storage tank collapsed, releasing more than 500,000 gallons of oil into the Monongahela River near Pittsburgh. 23,000 people went without tap water for about a week. Environmental officials in West Virginia say before last week's spill, there hadn't been an inspection of the Freedom Industries tanks in more than 20 years. In Pennsylvania, Schiffer says a tank like that would be inspected every 5 years.
And a qualified inspector actually goes inside the tank and takes readings, thickness readings, the tank bottom to ensure that there isn't any type of corrosion holes beginning to develop. So we have all those measures in place that West Virginia didn't necessarily have.
But not everyone thinks the Pennsylvania program is working. Myron Arnowitt is director of Clean Water Action. He cites the DEP's own statistics, which confirm about 1,500 leaks and spills from above and underground chemical storage tanks in the past 5 years. Most of those were minor, but still, he's concerned.
We're talking about a lot of problems going on out there where tanks are leaking, they're causing problems that need to be cleaned up, and there just isn't good compliance with the rules that are written down to protect the public.
Another major issue from the West Virginia spill has been location. The Freedom Industries chemical storage was 1.5 miles upstream of where the water treatment plant intakes drinking water. Everyone from water quality experts to comedian Jon Stewart have criticized this setup.
Why would you build your toxic chemical storage tanks upstream? And drinking water adjacent.
On Neville Island, the drinking water intake is in the center of the industrial zone. But leaders there say there's enough water quality monitoring to shut down intake if there's a spill. The Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority has also created a monitoring network in recent years to identify problems early and react accordingly. State emergency management officials did not respond to an interview request for this story, but Allegheny County Emergency Management has been coordinating plans with industry leaders, public officials, and citizens to prepare for emergencies like this. Despite all these efforts, some look at the catastrophe in West Virginia and ask themselves if it didn't happen in Pennsylvania because of planning and regulations or because of luck. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. The chemical spill in West Virginia has also sparked reaction in Kentucky. An Ashland city commissioner says the recent spill was a wake-up call. Cheryl Spriggs says Ashland took immediate action to safeguard its water from the Ohio River by shutting down its system and switching to its reserve supply. She says intake valves were closed until the chemical passed the Boyd County community as it continued flowing up the river. Although she applauds the city's response, Spriggs says Ashland needs to improve its emergency communications.
I think where we kind of came down flat-footed was in our emergency information dissemination to the public. So many of the people didn't know what was going on. A lot of people did not get the paper, even though we had it out there on all kinds of social media. I mean, we really need to have a plan, a really good plan, and I think that includes having a dedicated phone line.
Spriggs wants the city to develop a better plan for keeping citizens informed during emergencies. In Louisville, Kentucky, officials chose to keep the intakes open, trusting the chemical would be diluted enough to avoid any threat to human health. As the plume passed, officials reported that the water treatment plant was working as it should and there was no threat to the water supply. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. As West Virginians and people throughout the region struggle to make sense of the current chemical spill and resulting water crisis, for many it brings back not-so-distant memories of the events that unfolded in Kanawha Valley after the catastrophic Union Carbide leak in Bhopal, India. The following piece is a radio adaptation of Apple Shop's film Chemical Valley. Filmmaker Mimi Pickering brings us this report.
On December 3, 1984, the worst industrial accident in history occurred when 40 tons of methyl isocyanate, known as MIC, leaked from a Union Carbide pesticide plant in Bhopal, India. Rajesh Tandon from the Society for Participatory Research in Asia described the human impact.
We are talking about maybe about 5,000 people dead, which will be very hard to document because many people fled Bhopal and died in cities other than Bhopal. We're talking about at least 50,000 persons who are facing serious medical problems. There is no doubt that it is a carcinogen and it is a mutagen, that people who have been exposed will suffer for the rest of their life and future generations will suffer. There is no doubt about it.
The only place in the United States that manufactured MIC, which is used in the process of making pesticides, was the Union Carbide plant located in Institute in the Kanawha Valley of West Virginia. Plant manager Hank Carawan addressed the media on December 11th.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. All of us here at the Institute plant have been deeply saddened by the tragic event in India, and we extend our sympathy to all the people in the city of Bhopal. I'm pleased to have an opportunity to make a point here this morning. The employees of the Institute plant have been manufacturing MIC in an effective and safe manner for 17 years. We are extremely proud of that safety record.
Ernest Lane was a retired carbide employee and Charleston City Councilman.
It is the best insecticide, as far as I'm concerned, on the market. It saved the cotton crop in Egypt two or three different times. It also was used in India to reproduce and mass produce their wheat crop that saved thousands of people from starving to death. Matter of fact, about it, we used 2 years ago in a lab where they sprayed the vegetables with insecticide. After we analyzed them, we ate the rest of them. So I know it's not harmful.
And I just didn't believe that such thing as Bhopal could ever exist or would happen. But it really shook this community up. And please believe me, the community is still quaking.
That was Prince Ahmed Williams, a resident of Institute, which is a predominantly African-American community on the other side of the fence from the Union Carbide plant and home of historically black West Virginia State College. Mildred Holt also lives in Institute.
I came to Institute when I was 17 and one half years old, and I was a freshman at West Virginia State College. I thought this was the smelliest, dirtiest, and anything that's derogatory about the atmosphere. And it was hard to breathe here, but this was where I was going to college. They were already invading the community with the pollution, terrible pollution, but they wanted it not to be an attractive community. They would put the tanks and the so forth, and you know, all of that plant stuff right next to houses. I often wonder if it had been a white neighborhood, would they have done the same thing? Maybe if it had been a white underprivileged neighborhood, yes. But I know it wouldn't have happened if it would have been had it been people of affluency.
On May 4, 1985, Union Carbide resumed production of MIC at Institute after spending $5 million on improvements and assuring the community of the plant's safety. 3 months later, on August 11, 1985, 500 gallons of aldecarb, oxine, and methylene chloride leaked from the Institute plant. Plant officials waited 20 minutes before warning the community. 135 people were hospitalized.
This looked just like a fog, a mist in the morning, dew. My head's been hurting, man, sick in my stomach.
When they told you it was a leak, what was the first thing that went through your mind?
India, you're so helpless. There's nothing you can do, you know. How far can you run?
After the leak, reaction in the valley was divided. Current and former carbide workers fearful of losing jobs and retirement benefits, along with area business people and politicians, rallied in support of the corporation. But in Institute, residents formed people concerned about MIC and asked carbide officials to attend a public meeting. Donna Willis, Cheryl Whiteside, and Claire Smith were among those speaking out.
You fumble and stumble and cause our lives to be turned upside down over things you misplaced over 500 gallons of this mixture. Now, I can see misplacing 1 or 2 gallons of gasoline around your house. Who owes us for our gardens not being able to eat? And I'll tell you the truth, I would need it now. Because as I understand, most of the people I talk to in the Institute, their gardens didn't get checked. Whose garden got checked? Y'all gonna eat that mess?
Last Sunday, I got up on the interstate and they detoured me, so I came out right at the gates to Union Carbide. There was a blue light flashing. I realized there was a gas leak. I'm pregnant. I'm 2 months pregnant. I find out, I called everywhere to find out what the long-term effects were. I cannot get any information whatsoever. They tell me, first I find out it's a class one chemical that I was exposed to, not to worry about it. I come to find out it's a class four chemical that does cause birth defects, that has mutagenic effects, things like that. We just don't know. I'm just really frustrated right now. I don't want to find out 7 months from now that my baby's going to be deformed.
The great big corporation assured us that they had all these warning signals, that they had everything under control. But yet I'm across the street and I don't even hear a damn signal. By the time my family got up, the gas was all in our house. My two kids sleep in the front bedroom directly facing carbide. And I had fans in my house because I'm not fortunate enough to have central air conditioning and heating. And I had fans bringing gas in my house to my kids, trying to get ventilation. And yes, I'm outraged.
Robert Kennedy, president of Union Carbide Chemicals and Plastics, addressed the overflow crowd.
If we don't make those chemicals, someone will. You can wish the problem on somebody else. I had a dog once who was overly aggressive, and he bit a mailman once. And he missed a mailman about three times, and I was very upset about it.
Why don't you listen? I don't want to hear your dog story. We're talking about people and their lives and their homes and their family. A payroll number is 11554. You want it, you can have it. But I'm not going to quit. I'm going to be one of them employees out there making sure you hold by the safety rules. Making sure you hold.
That was Eric Howard, one of the few Union Carbide employees to register his concerns. After the leak, Union Carbide restarted MIC production, then sold the units to a French firm, Rhône Poulenc. Members of people concerned about MIC continued to press for answers to their questions about what hazardous chemicals were made and stored in the plants and the plans for community safety. Fred Millar, an expert on hazardous waste, assisted the group as they pressured officials to implement the provisions of the Community Right to Know Act, passed in the wake of Bhopal.
After Bhopal, we had a whole series of accidents in the United States that really shocked the American industry and shocked the American Congress, shocked the American people. A total of 6,928 accidents of a serious nature over a five-year period. We have just created an enormous factory making incredible amounts of these chemicals, and with nobody minding the store, nobody saying, what can we tolerate on this planet? It's partly because it's so new that it has been so unregulated, and partly because of the power of the chemical industry. What we need to do, of course, is to make the chemical industry socially accountable.
Despite opposition and foot-dragging from industry, regulators, and politicians, people concerned about MIC continued to press for the reduction of hazardous chemicals in the valley. After a 25-year battle, Bayer Crop Science, current owner of the Institute plant, agreed to close the MIC unit. Leslie Willis talked about what changed after Bhopal.
What happened with Bhopal and also with the Aldecarb thing here in Institute, something changed forever in our minds. I mean, never again are we going to go back to a time when the citizens are just going to trust. Our kids are at stake here. You know, the future of this valley is at stake here. And I don't want to leave it up to the people who are making lots of money off the stock, you know, dividends, who don't even live in the valley. I don't want to leave it up to them to make the decisions about what chemicals are produced, how they're produced, what's a minor incident. And I think what we have to do is concentrate on controlling our own backyard.
For WMMT, this is Mimi Pickering reporting.
Again, that was a radio adaptation of the Apple Shop film Chemical Valley. You can stream the film in its entirety for free online. A court decision that's expected later this year could decide the fate of a proposed Western Kentucky surface coal mine. For the past 2 years, residents and environmental groups have been campaigning against the mine, arguing it will irreparably damage the environment and erode nearby residents' quality of life. And as Kentucky Public Radio's Erica Peterson reports, they're using a unique and unexpected tool to fight the mine.
Carlin Gregory is driving his pickup truck up Russell Road in the tiny town of Utica near Owensboro. He's surveying the footprint of a surface mine proposed for the area.
Probably everything you see in front of you now is going to go. That house is going to go. They've signed with them. So they'll be coming around that knoll. Everything on the right-hand side here you can see.
He's talking about the Pleasant Ridge Mine, a project that would cover about 600 acres at the edge of Davis County. Coal company Western Kentucky Minerals estimates it can pull out about 2 million tons of coal there over the next decade. On one side of the road, there are people who have signed leases with the company. They're getting money for agreeing to let the company use the land for mining. Christina Taylor is on this side. Her husband's family has owned the land for nearly a century.
We've paid taxes all these years, and I think it's no more than right for us to be able to make a decision whether we want to mine or not.
But on the other side are people like Carlin Gregory, who won't profit from the venture, but will have to deal with declining property values, noise, and dust.
Yeah, it's very irritating, you know, to think that what you've done, you know, it's just all gone just because somebody wants to come in and strip mine.
And that's the conflict that's been going on for years in Utica. It's similar to the fight that happens whenever a new coal mine is proposed. But Davis County is a little bit different, and the mine's opponents have a unique tool. They're using one of the least sexy bureaucratic hurdles possible, zoning regulations. In almost all of Kentucky's counties, the decision whether to permit a coal mine falls to state and federal agencies. But Davis is one of only a few counties with countywide zoning. Land has to be zoned for mining before companies can file for permits. In 2012, the Davis County Planning Commission approved the rezoning for the Pleasant Ridge Mine. That decision was appealed to the county fiscal court, where it was upheld. Judge Executive Al Mattingly says he knows some residents are concerned about the mine.
But it's legal, and if they meet the requirements of the state and meet the requirements of the county, do you deny what is legal?
But the mine's opponents say it's not legal. Carlin Gregory and four others have filed a lawsuit appealing the planning board's zoning decision, arguing there wasn't due process of law, and the board made its decision based on an independent investigation by its chairman that wasn't subject to cross-examination. That case is currently before the Davis Circuit Court. The fight over Pleasant Ridge is just the beginning, and it's a beginning that could block future coal mines in Davis County. Both sides say it's about something bigger than this one coal mine. Christina Taylor will get $1.50 for every ton of coal mined on her land. But she says the community will be strengthened, too.
Everybody benefits from this. Everybody heats their house with it. You know, that makes employment. And that's what I don't understand. When people want to be negative, well, if it don't benefit me, I won't, you know. It's going to benefit everybody.
Western Kentucky Minerals estimates the mine will employ about 25 people directly, plus ancillary economic benefits to nearby businesses. Taylor sees the project as inevitable. Someone will come and mine the coal eventually, so why not now? But the mine's opponents are taking a longer view. The Sierra Club has been waging a campaign against coal-fired power plants, with the goal of reducing local pollution and the effects of climate change. The group's organizers see stopping the Pleasant Ridge mine as one step toward their overall goal of moving the region away from coal. There are more than a dozen coal-fired power plants within a 50-mile radius of Owensboro, and Sierra Club Pennyryle Group Chair Rick Fowler says tapping those underground coal reserves in Utica will only contribute to the larger problem.
The many are suffering for the good of the few in this battle. The people that own the coal mines and the money interests, they're gaining, and the rest of us are losing. If coal were the only way to produce electricity, then you know, I might have to rethink my position, but coal is not the only way to produce electricity.
A decision in the case is expected later this year. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Erica Peterson.
One of Lexington, Kentucky's poorest communities is waiting for a newly developed neighborhood. Many homes were demolished to make room for a new roadway. In return, residents were promised better housing and a restored community. However, tired of waiting, many residents have moved on. Kentucky Public Radio's Stu Johnson explores the project's impact on the community of Davis Bottom.
After years of discussion, then planning, and finally bulldozing, construction is underway in the Davis Bottom neighborhood. Over the years, Hazel Lambert has had many homes in that low-income community wedged between South Broadway and Versailles Road.
What I really liked about the bottom, where the trailers is now, they used to be a park, right? And we didn't get to go no place, and we could go down there, and they had ball games in the summertime. We could go down and see ball games and stuff like that, you know.
When the road extension came through, Lambert's residence was demolished. Like many of her neighbors, she was relocated into trailers in a nearby field, once home to those ball fields. The work will extend a Newtown Pike through the heart of downtown Lexington. To make way, homes have been demolished, and some occupants relocated into rent-free trailers. Throughout the road work, Lexington Planning Commissioner Derek Paulson says they're trying to protect the Davis Bottom neighborhood.
The goal with it was to really try to preserve that community aspect of it while really upgrading the physical parts of it. New infrastructure, sewer, stormwater, physical housing. And really, you know, to make it a place where there could be more opportunity.
Construction on an apartment complex should begin this spring. Displaced residents will be allowed into those new homes without a rent increase. That's the plan, but its success will in a large part depend on Lexington's new land trust. And when built, Trust Director Barbara Navin says it will provide working families with affordable housing.
We're talking about working people. We're not talking about people who, generally speaking, coming in who don't have an income or who don't have a job.
When complete, Davis-Bodden will have both rental housing and single-family homes. It should work because the land trust will retain control over the 26 acres. The buildings will be privately owned, but not the land. As a result, the homes should remain affordable and create long-term savings.
Is it the least expensive housing? No, it's going to be brand new. We're going to save people money on their energy costs by putting in Energy Star appliances, doing 2x6 construction, you know, really increasing the R value of the roof and the walls.
Navin says some residents could move into their new homes before fall. One of those residents will likely be Hazel Lambert, who now lives nearby in a trailer. The longtime resident of Davis-Bodden is happy for the upgraded home, but worries a bit about grocery shopping.
What we need down there, we need, for me, along other people too, I'm pretty sure, because my transportation is walking. And I have to walk. I have to get my son to come and take me to Kroger or something like that. And, you know, so we need more stores and stuff down there, you know.
City plans for the neighborhood eventually include a commercial development. Planning Commissioner Paulson says retailers who locate there will enjoy many of the same benefits and incentives as homeowners.
Some of the retail options and mixed-use options that will be in other areas of this neighborhood, they're still to be worked out. I think that, again, just sort of makes it a more sustainable neighborhood longer term. Rather than just housing people in an area, it's really the idea of how do we try to help build a neighborhood that can, you know, really function longer term.
Still, Paulson admits such improvements and developments may be years in the making. If the land trust concept works well in Davis-Bodden, Director Barbara Navin says it could be expanded and promote low-income housing in other areas of Fayette County. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Stu Johnson.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Pennsylvania has more than 5,500 miles of streams and rivers polluted with acid mine drainage. That's when a water flows through an old coal mine, picks up heavy metals, and turns a rusty orange color. Thousands of passive treatment systems around the state use the natural environment to clean up the water. Before passing, the late hydrogeologist Bruce Levitt introduced a new twist to passive systems that's expected to help clean up the state's waterways. We hear again from the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant and her trip with Levitt this fall.
Back when 63-year-old Bruce Levitt was on his college spring break, he didn't head to warm, sunny climes to party on the beach. He busted to Canada with other engineering students to look at coal mines.
We did not stop at this particular site, but just in driving by, somebody on the bus said, oh, that's the Ragged Chutes air compressor.
The 100-year-old compressor provided power to the silver mines in Ontario, but it didn't use electricity. Instead, it used the power created by water flowing down a cliff. It's called a trump.
It uses falling water to compress air. And every once in a while, you know, it'll shoot a jet of water 120 feet up into the air.
That impressed Levitt. But he didn't think much about the water-powered air compressor for nearly 40 years. Then a few years ago, the U.S. Office of Surface Mining put out a request for proposals. They wanted innovative ways to treat mine drainage without using electricity. Perhaps solar or wind power were the answer.
And I'm thinking, well, everybody's going to think of those. But in the back of my head, there was a thought that there's a way to compress air using falling water. And I started scratching around and rediscovered the Ragged Chutes air compressor.
Levitt drives me out toward the Pittsburgh airport to the site of the demonstration trump he created with the federal grant money. He had been struggling with pancreatic cancer the past couple of years. When we met, he was pale and almost alarmingly thin, but there was a gleam in his eye as we pulled off the highway and he opened the gates.
You ready for this? This is the site.
On the site is a series of holding ponds, which were originally built by the Montour Run Watershed Association as a passive water treatment system. The group allowed Levitt and the nonprofit he works with, Biomost, to add the trough to enhance its treatment. Levitt walks toward the first holding pond. It's not pretty. All the plants around the pond are dead, and the pond is thick with rusty water.
I mean, that just looks kind of gross.
Okay. Yep, it's a little bit yucky.
Water drains from a nearby coal mine into this pond. When it first enters, it's laden with heavy metals. Levitt wants to separate the iron molecules from the water molecules. To do that, he uses bubbles. How he creates those bubbles is what makes this treatment system unique, and we'll get to that in a minute. A tube in the middle of the pond shoots out the small bubbles, which aerate the water, releasing the iron.
And that will precipitate. That means it'll form a solid and come out of the water, and that solid can then settle to the bottom of the pond.
Those iron solids are what make the pond look so thick and orange. As the iron sinks to the bottom, the water drains out to the next holding pond. Over the course of a few days, water moves through a series of 5 ponds. The first few drain out iron, others use limestone and compost to pull out various heavy metals. By the time we get to the 5th pond, most of the pollutants are gone, and there's life all around.
Notice this pond. It's a whole lot greener.
There's duckweed on the surface and tadpoles swimming in the water. It's clean enough to be released back into Montour Run, which drains into the Ohio River. But first, it runs through the system that creates those bubbles.
All these white pipes you see ahead of us here, this is the tromp.
All we see is a set of 3 PVC pipes sticking out of the ground. Each set moves progressively down the hill. Water runs underground from the 5th pond into each tromp and down each of the vertical pipes. Levitt pulls the top off of one to take a closer look.
And what we're hearing here is the air bubbles being entrained in the water and being carried down the downpipe.
Air gets sucked in with the falling water, creating bubbles. Those air bubbles are then separated in the tromp and piped back up to the first pond as compressed air. This system can process up to 150 gallons of water per minute. The Montour Run Watershed Group calls the tromp a supercharger because it says polluted mine water moves through more quickly and efficiently than before, with few costs. Levitt and his partners have been working to scale it up, to build a tromp that can process 1,000 gallons per minute.
If you have the flow, if you have the discharge, you could install a tromp and aerate the water and not have to use any electricity at all.
That can reduce costs and help in efforts to stem climate change because there's no need to burn fossil fuels to create energy. They also take less physical space than some other passive water treatment systems. After a long career as a hydrogeologist for Consol Energy, Levitt retired early in part to pursue the tromp.
Do I feel like I have contributed? Yes, absolutely, I do. Hopefully this technology can be adopted and can thrive and improve the water quality at additional sites.
There are currently 4 tromps around the state cleaning up acid mine drainage at water treatment sites. BioMost has proposed a larger project to the Department of Environmental Protection, which it says would save the state $25,000 a year in electricity costs at one of its treatment plants. Industry insiders aren't sure whether the tromp can be scaled up for bigger projects, but BioMost and the Watershed Group say the tromp will play an important role in mine water cleanup in the coming years, and it will be one of Bruce Levitt's enduring legacies. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
A new program at the West Virginia Schools for Deaf and Blind in Romney is making it possible for students from across the state to take advantage of specialized instruction that's available there. Cecilia Mason of West Virginia Public Broadcasting has more.
3 years ago, the West Virginia Board of Education hired Dr. Lynn Boyer as superintendent of the Schools for Deaf and Blind. A new program started at the beginning of this school year offers deaf, hard of hearing, blind, and low vision students from across the state the opportunity to spend time on the Romney campus. The schools bring the students by bus once a month for a week so they can study and take advantage of the specialized instruction that's available.
So that it's really a full week immersion, if you will, in a culture that really provides to them role models in some ways, with teachers, with dorm personnel, and certainly with peers who have some of their same challenges.
Okay, so what would a shotgun hold? What's inside the shotgun?
I know.
Bullets.
Bullets, very good. So ammunition is like bullets. Okay, but what else can a magazine be?
Something you read?
Something you read, right.
Patty Myers is the teacher who works with the students during the week they spend on campus. The trip to Romney is part of the students' individual education plan, which is put together by counties to address meeting the needs of students with special challenges. Students come to Romney on Sunday and bring their regular classroom work so they don't fall behind in their studies.
And while they're with me, we are addressing all that curriculum. But we're also looking at various strategies, various approaches, some aids that they can use when they go back to their county. It gives them better access to their print materials. And we give them a lot of study techniques as well to use.
One goal is providing services that counties can't because there aren't experts available to offer them. Myers says one example is teaching students how to navigate around town. Staying on campus for a week also gives the students an opportunity to interact with adults and other children who are like them. Myers says they seem to enjoy the experience.
They come here each month, already established friendships. From the first month till now, you know, we get requests, I want to share a room with so-and-so because they have just made that close of friends. And they do work very hard with their county core curriculum. We even do 90 minutes every evening of homework, so that they can spend time with their friends once a month. And that's what makes it so nice. It's just been phenomenal.
The Schools for Deaf and Blind has offered the program since September, and Superintendent Lynn Boyer says anywhere from 7 to 15 students each month have participated. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Cecilia Mason.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. A new tool to train riverboat workers allows trainers to smack into bridges and barges without risking millions of dollars in damages. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Glennis Board reports.
The tri-state port of Huntington is the largest inland port in America, bigger than Baltimore. And bigger than Philadelphia, based on the tonnage that travels through. That river activity accounts for more than $1.5 billion of West Virginia's economy, as well as some 10,000 jobs. And the inland maritime industry is projecting a 1.5% growth annually over the next decade. The Inland Waterways Academy has been training folks to fill these river jobs, everything from deckhands to captains, for the past 14 years. And now they're equipped with a training tool that the school's director, John Whiteley, says is only one of a handful throughout the country.
This is your con. It shows you your speed, your direction, your throttle settings, your rudder angle indicator, everything like that. Gives you your heading, your speed over the ground, set and drift, which if you're not a sailor, you probably don't know what it is.
Whiteley is the executive director of workforce development for Mount West Technical and Community College, in addition to being the director of the Inland Waterways Academy at Mount West. He's standing at the helm of a faux pilot house, throttles in front of him, surrounded by screens that show a Coast Guard boat and choppy waters in all directions.
So we're coming into Brunswick, Georgia, which is the submarine base. We have a radar display that actually indicates what you would see on the radar in this area. The next thing up there is an electronic chart that tells you where you are.
Whiteley says he and his staff have just finished training on the simulator so they can now begin to train students and offer opportunities for experienced boat workers to get additional training too.
And the instructor who's sitting outside the wheelhouse can give it a steering failure, an engine failure, a fire in the engine room, a lot of different scenarios to see how the trainee is going to react to it. Mm-hmm. And we're filming the trainee all the time. When the scenario is done, we then take them into a debrief room and we can show them what they did and talk them through it. And that's where the learning actually takes place.
He says, while the simulator doesn't physically move, the 180-degree visuals leave many rocking back and forth nonetheless.
I used to be in the Coast Guard, and I lived on Governor's Island in New York. And New York was one of the model ports that we had. And I actually, going up the upper bay, went past Governor's Island, I could see the building I lived in. I could see the windows of my apartment. They're that realistic. The people from Transys, which is the company that we bought it from, they will actually go down the river on a boat and take photographs of everything around. Mm-hmm. And then they'll also model the river itself, the depths and things like that. Of course, you've got all the bends and everything. Mm-hmm. And the boat will react the way a normal boat would react.
Whiteley talks about Cincinnati, for example, that has five bridges, none of which line up, and how much training it takes to be able to navigate through. He even let me steer a tugboat.
Sure. And you can see that you're actually starting to move a little bit to starboard, but we aren't going to make it.
Art?
Nope, no. We have a collision.
What happens when you have a collision?
It just stops the exercise.
Oh, okay.
Collision with a target.
See? But see, when you have a collision, you just start it all over again.
Well, I will stick to navigating through radio waves. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Ford in Huntington.
Our last segment is a reflection on water supplies across the globe from essayist Kat Pleska called Water, Water Everywhere.
I learned to take a bath in a teacup, I often chortled to anyone who would listen. A slight exaggeration, of course, but one time, when I had been without water for 5 weeks, I learned to adapt. Plus this important lesson, I'll never take water for granted again. It was the late 1970s, and my husband and I lived a back-to-the-land life, a strong national trend at the time. We had chosen a home situated at the end of a road at the top of a hill that needed much remodeling and repair. One winter, sub-zero temperatures lasted for several days, followed by weeks of below-freezing temperatures. Our basement heat was inadequate, and we went downstairs one morning to discover a forest of bizarrely twisted water pipes. They seemed to reach out from their valves as if seeking sustenance or begging for help. But it was a helpless feeling for us, as we had no money for a plumber. My husband eventually replaced the pipes, but by that time I had learned to melt the plentiful snow for cooking, fill jugs of water at friends' houses, and to prevail upon family for the occasional shower. Recently, in the western part of West Virginia, thousands of people endured a week-long ban on water. During this crisis, emotions ran high. They still do. People commented the same thing I did years ago. Never take water for granted. This time, we had water at our house, and I invited friends over to shower and wash clothes. It was not easy for some to show up, washcloth and towel in hand, and climb into someone else's tub. Yet it strengthened our relationships as those of us fortunate enough to have water reached out to those who didn't. We felt we had contributed to easing the crisis for some in a small way. On a larger scale, our world is running out of potable water. When I visited Peru a few years ago, my guide told me that when new homes are built, they have to rent water from their neighbor's well, only 1 hour a day. The norm for the foreseeable future is no newly dug wells. Conservation and protective practices are ways to extend our time with safe, clear water, sparkling over our hands and slaking our thirst. Trust is again an issue in the news, and just as my friends felt a sense of trust in order to bathe in my home, trust must be restored that the water we use is plentiful and healthy for consumption. We really don't have much time remaining to make good water our reason for living. Its very essence is why we thrive.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Morehead State Public Radio in Morehead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, WHYY in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.